Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone. I'm filling in for George Norrie and George Knapp. And it is fantastic to be back here talking about the things that I love to talk about. In fact, not only am I passionate about the subjects on Coast, I've actually lived my life pursuing them, traveling around the world, going to places where few go, just to explore the metaphysical aspects of different cultures. And what I realize is the things that we talk about on Coast are really some of the most fundamental things in life. It really speaks to the keys of human experience that simply do not get airtime anywhere else. And today on the show, we're going to talk about just that. We're going to talk about a different way to engage life. We're going to talk about conscious media and what the bleep do we know. Now, this was a phenomenon that came out about 10 years ago. It was a movie that has since gone around the world, and it opened the door. It really established conscious media. As you remember, it was a movie with Marlee Maitland, an Oscar-winning actress, and it was kind of a PBS Nova special meets My Big Fat Greek Wedding. It was really fun in the sense that they had a scripted element to it. But the underlying message was that your thoughts create your actions and your actions create your destiny. And if you want to change the world around you, it starts by changing the world inside you. So it was an extraordinary film in the sense that it was kind of an entertaining film, but it really triggered profound thought within people. And it got people just to shift the way they look at themselves and look at the possibility of what they're able to do. So in the later hours, we're going to talk to Jay-Z Knight, who is the founder of the Ramtha School of Enlightenment, whose students and herself were responsible for making What the Bleep Do We Know. A lot of people don't realize that. They saw her in the film, and we're going to talk to her about her life, about her Ramtha experience, and we're going to talk about much, much more. There's a lot of predictions that have come through her, through this Ramtha entity. And we're going to discuss how many of them have come true and what that means for you and I and a whole bunch more. But in the first hour, just a few moments, we're going to talk to Dean Haglund. Now, Dean is someone you have probably seen, I don't know, hundreds of times before. He was an actor on The X-Files. He's probably best known for his 9 seasons on The X-Files, playing Langley, one of those computer nerds called the Lone Gunman. Every time that Mulder and Scully had a problem, they would go to these guys and they would hack some of the answers for him. It was on Fox for a long time, and of course he was also in the movies. And the first time I met Dean, I don't know, about 6 years ago, I was interviewing him for my London show. I've been doing a talk show in London for about 10 years that I produce here in Los Angeles, where I now live. And it was so extraordinary because Dean is such a gifted comedian. And of course, he's a great actor as well. But his improv skills are legendary. In fact, that's what he does quite a bit, is these incredible X-Files improv shows. And we actually did a skit on the air, unrehearsed, where I was Mulder and he played somebody else. And we did this back and forth. It really impressed upon me this guy's ability to think outside the box. And he's just come up with a new documentary called The Truth Is Out There, where he himself goes where his character once went in exploring the deepest conspiracies with some of the top researchers in the world. So stay tuned. Come up with Dean Haglund right after this. We're back on Coast to Coast AM. And our next guest is Dean Haglund. Of course, you've seen him on The X-Files and The X-Files movies, but some interesting things you might not know, that there was an episode of The Lone Gunman, which was a spinoff of The X-Files, where they had a plane crashing into the World Trade Center less than 6 months before it actually happened. A lot of strange things went on with that show, and we're going to find out about Chris Carter, the inner workings of the show, and some amazing real-life stories about Dean's own experience with the strange and unusual. Dean, welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, Rob. Thanks a lot for having me here.
It's my pleasure. You know, of course, people know you from the show, and that was a big part of your life. That was, what, 9 years?
Technically 10 years, 9 seasons.
Yeah.
So it went over 10 years in total.
Mm-hmm.
which is a big, you know, yeah, it was a long time.
It was a long time. You were one of the computer experts, and there was two other guys that you always hung out with.
Yes, there was three of us. We worked at a basement. We put out a conspiracy newspaper called The Lone Gunman. So collectively, we're called The Lone Gunman, even though there was three of us. I know the math didn't really work out there. But I played the one who had long blonde hair and horn-rimmed glasses, so I looked like Garth from Wayne's World.
Yeah, well, you were everybody's favorite because the other guy wore a suit and we couldn't really relate to him. And the other guy was, you know, a little pudgy and kind of dry. So you were the one we all gravitated to.
Okay, you know, the pudgy, dry guy, Frohickey, who you're referring to.
Yeah.
I like to point out that in London, where your show is, there was a sci-fi magazine that voted him the sexiest man in science fiction one year.
Well, I stand corrected.
I know, right? So consider that when next time you record.
Sure. Well, no, of course, it was an amazing show. And here's something I've always wanted to say about this show, The X-Files, because listening to Coast and everyone who's been listening to Coast for all these years knows that these episodes would key in and pull from Coast to Coast material. We'd see things about abductions and things about, you know, MUFON meetings and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it really came out of a lot of Coast programs. Don't you think that Chris Carter really used this program as a source for his writing?
Yeah, absolutely. It was Coast to Coast and, you know, these FBI files. It was actually very interesting going into the writer's room when the show was on because it was the books on their library shelf was not typical. You know, there would not be how to write a screenplay, you know, 10 best movies of 1980s. Instead, they'd be like the ancient rites of Mithra and top 10 conspiracies, you know, and all these things. And this sort of would be Chris Carter and the other writers that their field of interest that then they would bring into the TV show, which, you know, was very popular and brought up a lot of these issues into the popular culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's gone on now. There's a big hole, it would seem, in television. Why do you think there hasn't been a show that has come to rival or sort of take up where X-Files have left off?
Well, you know, Fringe is trying to do that. They've gone into sort of parallel universes and stuff like that. But the first season there, they were really trying to mirror and capture some of that again. I think it's very hard to do in popular culture because, you know, there is a thought that by making it entertaining, you are undermining the truth of it, you know, that you are, there were a lot of people in the UFO world that came up to me going, yeah, you know, the problem with the X-Files is that now that when you try to go and actually report a sighting or some sort of experience, everybody goes, you just watch too much X-Files, that you're suddenly blown off as someone who's just embraced the popular culture. So,
yeah.
You know, this is this was this dilemma that was going on, and that perhaps is why we don't see as many conspiracy TV shows in popular culture these days.
Interesting. Well, there was a spinoff that not many people knew about, and I don't know if this episode, it did air, right? The one where it sort of predicted 9/11 before it happened?
Yes, that was our pilot episode.
Okay.
And so in that pilot episode, there is a computer chip, and basically the stunning climax of the whole episode is there is a 747, one of the lone gunmen's on that plane. We think there's a bomb on it, but in fact, the plane has been taken over by remote control and it's being flown directly into the World Trade Center. And so we have to endeavor to take control back over the plane. And at the last second, we get the plane back in control and it just flies over the top of the building. So it doesn't actually connect. The day is saved by the lone gunman. But the footage, you know, it's all done in green screen, of course, but planes heading straight towards the World Trade Center is eerie to watch now in light of what happened 8 months later.
8 months later.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well, here's an interesting thing, because you are really the only one from the cast that had a genuine interest in these phenomenons.
Well, I don't know if I am the I think everyone was sort of interested.
Okay.
I was the one that researched my role, you know.
Well,
not to say that, that's not to belittle the other actors who did not. Everybody researched their role, but I suddenly was out there meeting the likes of Jordan Maxwell and Dr. Roger Lear and these guys who, you know, were helping me inform what my character was talking about, you know, so that I could understand some of the really intelligent writing that Chris Carter and the other writers were doing.
Okay.
So by meeting these guys, then I was introduced to a lot of other conspiracies and deeper ideas and fundamental ways of actually existing, you know, in the world. So
yeah. Well, on the, you know, on the set, did you ever have any conversations with Gillian Anderson or David Duchovny about paranormal experiences or their thoughts on a...
Yeah, you know, it was funny, actually. It was a bit of the inverse. It was sort of Gillian was more a believer of this stuff, and David wasn't. You know, he sort of thought, well, it may or may not be true. But Gillian sort of thought, you know, oh, my gosh, is that, like, she was a lot more keen on finding out about this stuff. It's similar to the gunman, you know, Bruce Harwood, who played Byers, the one in the suit, is very much a non-believer in UFOs. He believes it's more of a Jungian collective hallucination, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that fascinating because his ideas, you know, he's in our documentary as well, talking about these things. And I you know, it is a valid argument as well. So it's a funny range that all of us had on set.
You know, that's one of the great scenes in your documentary, The Truth Is Out There, is that you guys, for the first time, are reunited since the end of The X-Files.
Yeah.
And it turns out you guys never talked about this stuff while you were filming.
I know. Isn't that amazing? Well, because you're so busy. I mean, we shot 16-hour days. We were trying to make every episode look like a feature film. You know, the quality and the effort that went into that was extraordinary. And so... there was very little time to just sort of kick back and sit around a table and just sort of chat about the stuff that you were always sort of working or memorizing lines or, you know, working with rewrites and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually, yeah, really great to have us all just sort of sit back and discuss this stuff on the documentary.
Now, you come from a pretty well-established comedic background. Tell us about your improv shows.
Yes. Well, my background, of course, I was... if you watch Whose Line Is It Anyway, Ryan Stiles and Colin Mochrie, I was in the same theater group as they were for 15 years and developed a bunch of improvisational skills that I now take to sci-fi conventions around the world where not only do I improvise solo, I make up X-File improv. I make up X-File episodes, improvise, bringing audience members up on stage to play Mulder and that sort of thing. Which I've taken to Edinburgh Fringe Festival and toured around. But now I also do Stargate episodes with Gary Jones and I called Starhole. And just last weekend, I was in Vegas at the Star Trek convention with Denise Crosby improvising Q versus Tasha Yar, which was hilarious. So, yeah, my improv skills have taken me very far.
So there are still new episodes of The X-Files being produced.
There is. Yes, on stage only.
On stage only.
Yeah, and by them being improv, they quickly go off the rails. I mean, everybody asks, oh, which episode are you doing? And I'm saying, well, you know, it's a brand new episode because whatever the audience shouts out, I incorporate into the show. So there's no way of actually controlling it because I'm basing it on the whims of whatever suggestion I get. So from there, it quickly either evolves or devolves. Depending on how drunk the audience is, I guess.
Right. You never know.
You know how that goes.
Yeah. It's an open bar. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay. So the thing about you is that you're just an interesting person for a lot of reasons. But, you know, you lived as an actor for so long doing a fictional account of these real life paranormal situations. And from that, in your real life, you have now started to explore and get involved in these paranormal type of events. So there's all this sort of cross experience that you've been living.
Yeah. You know, that's fascinating because I didn't really realize how extraordinary that was until I started doing a weekly podcast called Chillpack Hollywood Hour, just putting a plug in there, with my co-host, Mr. Phil Lernes, who is a filmmaker and also co-producer. And he said, you know, you are in an extraordinary position and we should do a documentary about this. And from that, he picked up the camera and followed me around for an entire year around the world as we went to conventions and started interviewing a lot of people like, you know, Dr. Bob Dean, David Sarita, Dr. Roger Lear, Richard Dolan, you know, all the big names. And then put this into this documentary to examine what is, you know, what is truth? How do you know you found the truth? Even though the other person says you are way off from the truth, you know, these were the questions we asked, and it came out kind of compelling and much a surprise to me because, you know, when you live it, you can't see the forest for the trees, and seeing the movie from the way he edited it and seeing that perspective is also been quite a surprise to myself.
Well, yeah, you went around, you talked to a lot of different people. Was your opinion of conspiracies or things that were mysterious changed after you talked to all these experts?
Yeah, you know, it was because, well, I don't think I came in with a lot of preconceived ideas. I mean, I know these guys, and there were, some of them are terrific public speakers, you know. Alex Jones has his own radio show. Lee McCloskey is a speaker and an actor as well. And, you know, a lot of these guys are very compelling on their own. And I was just, you know, happy to be in their presence. And I would thought that, you know, I would give them the chance to sort of speak as they do. But as we started having a conversation and as we started, you know, really getting into it, the things that they said and the way that the conversation developed was a complete surprise, having never heard some of this stuff from them before. And it sort of blew away my ideas altogether.
Well, you get to travel a lot. You get to go and talk to a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. What kind of things have you picked up on as far as some of these conspiracies goes, whether it's about Hollywood or whether about it's the cover-up of an extraterrestrial presence? Have people whispered in your ear?
Well, yeah, you know, there's a couple of things. One thing that we learned is that, well, that was really amazing to me, that as Mark Bennett said, there are not really any conspiracies. It's just business as usual. That a lot of these things that we call conspiracies are, you know, the way capitalist structures are set up. It's a pyramid scheme. The information comes from the top down on a need-to-know basis, and that, you know, it is sort of whispered, as is the Latin word conspire, to whisper, is the way that information travels through businesses. So what seems like a conspiracy is, in fact, just business as usual. And once that concept sort of reverberated through our documentary, then you saw things in a completely different light. And it really was from there where things took off. So,
yeah, I imagine as you do this more and more, you get a chance to hear a lot of different perspectives. Is there one driving idea that you firmly believe? I mean, when you hear a lot of different stories, you have to put them all together. What do you see as far as, like, the cover-up of the extraterrestrial phenomenon? Do you firmly believe that?
Well, yeah. I mean, Richard Dolan, who's, you know, a brilliant academic, he made a very good point that he truly believes there is a cover-up because there's so much information out there that even if they were to come forth and say, okay, it's all true, then there's a lot of follow-up questions, be it how did you keep this secret? How did you keep the media from reporting it? How did you keep even academia from, you know, investigating this? You know, it reverberates through so many aspects of the society that concept really was rather reverberating.
So you believe that yourself?
Well, you know, here's the thing about the whole documentary is the belief or non-belief sort of dissipates in that the information that's coming out, you know, I have the ability, I find, to be have a duality of my thinking in that I can believe and not believe at the same time. It's almost quantum thinking, if you can imagine that, so that as much as the one person says, yes, it is a cover-up, someone else will go, here's the reasons it's not a cover-up, and or it's a Jungian hallucination. Also, I can believe as well and embrace at the same time and not have to shut out that information and not have to go, well, that guy's crazy and that guy's right.
You know? Right. No, I know what you mean. You can hold a lot of dissenting opinions in your mind at one time. Stay right there. I want to talk to you about a UFO crash that you told me and have never talked on the air before. When we come back, you're listening to Coast AM. Yes, welcome back. We're talking with Dean Haglund, someone who has lived real-life X-Files. We're going to talk about that right after the break. Stay there. We're back talking with Dean Haglund about the X-Files. And Dean, I want you to tell a story that really was a gem. We just discovered last time we were talking about the fellow that you met at, I think, at a conference who was in the military, had his knees replaced, and told an incredible story about a bizarre alien encounter in Central America.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, this always happens to me when I'm on the road because everybody wants to, you know, they love the X-Files, and then they all will tell me their personal experiences. And some of them are, you know, I saw a light in the sky or something like that. But this guy was in the military, and we're in a bar, and he goes, yeah, I was in the first Gulf War, the 91, and whatever, I had Gulf War syndrome, and my knees turned to jelly, basically, and had them replaced. And he was then assigned down to Central America, where the School of America's, you know, train, and there's a military base down there. And he was given what's considered a cushy job, which is just guarding some of the hangars out there and all that sort of thing. So he's in the he's got the graveyard shift, right? So it's midnight to 6 a.m. One evening, and he gets a call from one of the sentries out at the beach. And the sentry says, a submarine has just surfaced at the beach, and they've come ashore, and they're having a barbecue, of all things. And it's sort of a restricted space, and, you know, these sort of things are completely uncommon. So he drives out there. He goes, what are you guys doing? We're having a barbecue. This is restricted space. We're having a barbecue, and this just goes on in a circle. Suddenly, he gets a call from another sentry where there's one road leading into this jungle. And this is a very remote jungle. No, you know, people just don't drive by. It's the sentry saying, there's a car here, and it's filled with two and three-star generals. They're all sitting in there, and they want access to the base. And
so they came unannounced to this little sleepy, and it's not really a base. It's kind of just a couple hangars?
A couple hangars, yeah. There's basically two hangars, and then the rest of it is jungle for training. You know, that's all it's used for. And this is considered, you know, in Central America, it's sort of like the easiest gig because you're not going to see any of this action. So suddenly these generals are here unannounced. So he goes over there. He goes, you know, we are under orders to shoot anybody who comes on. Well, we're coming in. Well, we can't do that. And then the guy in the back goes, here, call this phone number. And he recognizes it as a direct access Pentagon phone number. And he's going, well, I'm not going to call the Pentagon. It's 3:30 in the morning. So you're allowed on the base, but we are going to follow you. And they go, that's fine. So they come on. And then as they're driving in, he's proceeding to go back to the beach to talk to these guys who are having a barbecue from the submarine. And suddenly there's helicopters in the sky. And they're coming and they're landing on the hangar. So he goes back over there. And suddenly the generals drive right to the hangar. They all run in. They are stopped from entering the hangar. All the guards that are there are stopped from entering the hangar. They see somebody run out from the helicopter into that same hangar, holding a bundle. And then they all immediately rush out, and then the car drives proceeds directly to the beach where the guy's having the barbecue, just kick over the barbecue, and then all of them proceed out into the submarine. The submarine submerges, and then it takes off, and they track it, and it goes up the Sea of Cortez side in between Baja and Mexico towards California. And then that's it. They never hear of anything again. The car drives away with the one driver. The generals are gone, and the helicopters fly away.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. And all of them sit around, and these are, you know, trained military guys, and the only thing they can come up with is that there was a UFO crash and that they had an alien that they took up somewhere to, like, Area 51 or some base. This was the only explanation that they could come up with.
So they were carrying a bundle. Was it wrapped in a blanket or something?
Yeah,
it sounds like it.
He said it was like imagine, and it seemed like that it was very urgent, and that it seemed like a, you know, a small form, like you're cradling it like a baby. And he was they can only see it from, you know, on the ground looking up to the roof. And then they saw the guy run out of the helicopter with it. So it was, yeah, it was wrapped in some sort of blanket or bundle. And that's all they saw. And all of these guys, you know, they went through every possible, you know, is this a test? Was it military training? What could it possibly be? And that's the only explanation they came up with.
You know, if they're holding it in their arms and it's a bundle, you would think that it's something living, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Or that you're trying to care for it, or, you know, that this is some sort of emergency medical thing, or, you know, that it seemed very nurturing as in a way or something. So, yeah, it was quite a remarkable story.
But did it give you a sense of how long ago it happened?
Yeah, so he gave me a sense that it would have been like mid-90s, somewhere in 95-ish.
Okay.
As a possible timeline. And then after that, you know, they all have to file a report. And so they just reported these things and filed it and never heard anything.
Hmm.
And then a couple of years later, he was discharged honorably and still goes and has his knees work done.
We hear about these stories happening sometimes, and often when something like that occurs, there's a follow-up visitation by guys who threaten everyone and tell them not to speak and all that stuff, but that never happened.
That never happened. That was the weird thing, because it seemed like, A, the story, if told, seems very extraordinary, and B, you know, I think there was, it seemed like there was not enough, like they didn't go into the hangar, so they were kept away from all the key things. And that the cover of, you know, the submarine just having a barbecue, you know, they were doing enough to make it seem like, oh yeah, no, it was just you were mistaken. The submarine guys were having a barbecue, and the generals just drove and picked up the guy from the helicopter, and then knew the submarine was there, and they all took off.
Extraordinary. Well, yeah. You hear a lot of these things, and there was another story that you told me one time that I thought really tied in with other. People talking about Hollywood and CIA. You know, Jesse Ventura was on this program, and he talks about when he was governor, he was informed that there were people in the CIA that had positions of government in his state. And I think that was one of the most extraordinary revelations, because it's easy to think that if they're in his state, they're going to be in other states too.
Yeah.
And you told a story about a woman psychic.
That's right.
Who talked about the CIA infiltration of Hollywood.
Right, and I've met her a couple of times. Yeah, she's a professional psychic, and she said that she met Chris Carter one time before the X-Files started, because she was at a Hollywood party and she saw a guy in a tuxedo. It was a big lavish red carpet party, and he was sort of standing over in the corner by himself, and she walked over to him and she goes, "I'm a psychic, and I'm telling you that whatever you're working on is going to be hugely successful. It's going to make you millions of dollars." And that was about a year before the X-Files started. And then I asked her, "Oh, well, what were you doing at the big red carpet party?" And she goes, "Oh, well, that's a funny story. I was hired by the CIA to go to parties." And I went, "Excuse me?"
Double take.
Yeah. I said, she said, no, I don't know how. Yeah, I got an email one time and said, would you go to this party? And all you have to do is write an email and report back what you talked about and who you talked to and that sort of thing. And so she goes, yeah, sure, and didn't think anything of it at first, but then she would go to these parties that she thinks she had, you know, a huge amount of security that she didn't think she would be on the list. And she would walk up and say her name, and sure enough, she would be on the guest list and walk in and just sort of mingle and chat and talk to people and then go home and go, yeah, well, you know, talk to this guy and that sort of thing, and they're working on this movie. And, and then report back. And then the next weekend they go, okay, you're going to this party. And so she would, for like a couple of years, the CIA was sending her to Hollywood parties just to keep tabs on, I guess. It sort of made sense, that if you use film as a way of moving foreign policy or foreign relations, you know, that you want to keep tabs on what filmmakers are thinking, what is the general consensus going on. So I think that was her role in that sort of thing. It was really extraordinary, though.
Yeah, I've heard stories like this from other people. Do you think she was being honest?
I do, actually, because... you know, I've heard from other people, you know, there was Operation Mockingbird for a while, which was the idea of making movies specifically. And even the FBI recently have been doing screenwriting workshops where they've said, oh, yeah, well, you come to the FBI and we'll, you know, tell you about procedure and that sort of thing. If you're going to do procedurals, TV shows, we'll show you exactly how we work. But also then they go and they meet these screenwriters and they sort of get into a closer relationship with the making of both TV and film and, the way the government operates.
Well, okay, if there is an influence being put upon these filmmakers and screenwriters, do you think there's a general curve or sort of a general theme that these all guys are pushing, or is it... each department, do you think, is doing different things?
Well, here's the funny thing, and this is sort of where Phil Lernes and I, we often discuss this back and forth, and he finds it a bit insulting because the idea of the filmmaker being a tool of government propaganda is a bit insulting because the filmmaker works from the pre-conscious and the subconscious and has these ideas and works in context of sociological phenomena, you know, and so they're artists first and foremost, and if they tap into some sort of zeitgeist or some sort of curve of any sort, that is the role of the artist. At the same time, it would be not unheard of for, people in a position of power to want to have influence on that just because movies are seen around the world. It's billions and billions of dollars of industry, and it's highly influential on public thought, both conscious and unconscious. So, you know, again, both sides of those arguments seem totally valid to me.
Hmm. Well, okay, you worked on The X-Files for 10 years. Do you think that there was any outside influence working through Chris Carter or any of the other producers or writers?
You know, I have been asked this many times, and there's been even FBI agents come up to me and you know, guys who swear they work at Area 51 or whatever, and said, you are, you know, where do you get your information? It seems very close to what we're working on and that sort of thing. And at the same time, these guys were sweating over a computer nearly 24 hours a day. And the concept of some guy in a suit walking in and going, okay, we're changing this whole plot line and it's going to work like this, seems kind of ludicrous because these guys had to put out an episode every 7 days and, you know, and shoot all of that stuff. I mean, it was an incredible amount of workload that seemed ridiculous that anyone could come in and tell them what to do because they were flying basically by the seat of their pants.
Yeah. Well, you're new film that you put out, this documentary called The Truth Is Out There, looks at all these different conspiracies.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see you sort of inside these worlds. A lot of them are something we've talked about quite a bit on Coast to Coast, extraterrestrials, 9/11, the Federal Reserve System, for example. What were your thoughts on talking with people about this particular conspiracy?
Well, you know, that was G. Edward Griffin who talked a lot about, who wrote the deal at Jekyll Island.
The monster from Jekyll Island.
The monster from Jekyll Island. Yeah,
because the Federal Reserve was started on a place called Jekyll Island.
I know, of all things.
Huh? Yeah.
And, you know, he was quite remarkable in that sort of thing because, you know, I sort of was saying the free market, you know, these things are supposed to be self-correcting and that sort of thing. And he said, you know, everybody thinks that, but the answer is that's a resounding no, that these are... that the Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express. You know, it's a private thing. And that he, a lot of it, what we didn't put in the documentary, which is in the bonus feature, we have a two-disc bonus DVD set that has a lot of the interviews extended because, you know, the regular documentary is about 141 minutes. And then the bonus, 80 minutes of bonus material, sort of goes into detail a lot more on a lot of these things. And in that, that's where D. Edward Griffin talks about how the Federal Reserve seems to be manipulated and that it is planned almost. I found that extraordinary, and his evidence was really compelling for it. And, you know, as he said, if the banks fail, that's a horrible thing, but we'll recover. But if the country fails, there's no recovering.
So he was advocating letting the banks fail and sort of rewriting this whole economic system.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was so funny because I was saying, well, so what is your IRA plan? You know, what's your 401k? And he said, it's talking to you. And I thought, wow, that is a huge amount of responsibility that his whole hope for an economic future recovery is to go out there and talk about this sort of thing and get it out in documentaries like our own.
You know, yeah, you sort of went in depth. You talked about population control in your documentary.
Yes. Yeah, that was Dr. Stanley Monteith. He and a couple other people, you know, it came up again and again. What's remarkable is as we talk to people, there'd be these through lines, these connections between different people we interviewed where, you know, the ayahuasca plant and the population control and food manipulation and genetic modification of our food stuff, different speakers who don't even normally talk about that would bring these sort of things up. And we sort of tied them all together through our documentary. But Dr. Stanley Monteith talked at length about this idea of all our food supply being purposely genetically manipulated to as a population control method. And it was pretty dark. And I even asked him, you know, how with all this information, what do you eat for breakfast? And he said he had a grapefruit. So... which he assured me was organic. So I guess that's, some good information that we put out there.
Do you think it's hard to wake people up to some of these ideas because they're a little too far for them to go or even, you know, comprehend fully?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's sort of the thing. A lot of documentaries about this sort of stuff just sort of lay out all these facts and, beat you over the head with it, and it becomes... very dark, not a lot of light in it. And so we do not make light of these ideas, but I like to think we bring a lightness of being to it, you know, that how the idea of how do you continue, how do I continue to do comedy once I know all this information? You know, how do you still smile and laugh and live in the world as you hear idea of population control and economic failure and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you bring your humor to it and your quick wit, so it is really something to watch. People, where can people go to get this film or and at least to see the trailer?
Yes. Well, the trailer's up online. It's at truth-is-out-there.com. So the truth is out there with dashes in between all the words.
Yep. And it's also linked up at coasttocoastam.com.
Right.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Our Facebook page, which is Facebook/truthmovie.
It's brilliant. Thanks so much, Dean. Coming up in the next hour, we're talking to Jay-Z Knight. What the bleep do we know? Prophecies that have come through her channeling of Ramtha. And Earth changes. Are they on our immediate horizon? She would say yes, with some startling predictions. More when we come back. My name is Rob Simone. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.